From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a question. What do Alexander's ragtime band, Jeepers Creepers, and I Get a Kick Out of You have in common? Well, they are all part of the Great American Songbook, a canon of popular American music written in the early 20th century. What makes a Great American Songbook, what qualifies a song to be part of that Great American Songbook anyway? When you hear the songs, you can probably sense the era during which they were written, 1920 to 1950. You may describe them as sentimental, perhaps a little predictable, sometimes very witty. As lyricist E.Y. Harburg said, words make you think a thought. Music makes you feel a feeling. A song makes you feel a thought. How does it do that? Well, co-authors Michael Lasser and Harmon Greenblatt explore the art and craft of the Great American Songbook in their new book, Say It With a Beautiful Song. As they will tell us this hour, you only notice the craft if you look for it. They help us understand how to look for it. And we're going to listen to some of the music with live accompaniment. You know, listen, listeners have said today, hey, well, let's do a little presidential debate recap. And I'm not going to put Harmon and Michael Lasser through that. We're going to do that tomorrow. 1A covered debate recap today. We are covering it tomorrow. Today, sometimes you need a little break from the maelstrom of politics and international news. And sometimes you need a little music and a smile. And one of the great storytellers I know is with me. Michael Lasser is back with us. It is so good to see you.
And you, Evan. It's always good to be here.
How are you doing these days?
I'm hanging in there.
That's good enough, right?
Well, it's what there is at my age.
Harmon Greenblatt with us as well, co-author of Say It With a Beautiful Song, The Art and Craft of the Great American Songbook. Hello, Harmon.
Hi, I'm here.
It's great to have both of you with us. Alan Jones, a pianist, is going to be performing a little for us as well.
He is.
He can hear us. I don't think we can hear him right now, but that will change. Michael, let me just start with this here. You know, you've written a lot about the Great American Songbook over the years.
Yep.
Why did we need a new book? And tell me what the mission was here.
Okay. There are lots of books out there about the Great American Songbook. Biographies, memoirs, histories, discussions of Broadway musicals, discussions of Hollywood musicals, and on and on. But none of them does what this book does. That is, we set out to talk about what makes it what it is. What distinguishes it? What makes it distinctive? What are the parts, the elements, the components? Although I don't want to talk about it like we're putting a machine together. and the result is this body of song, largely between 1920 and 1950, when there were more great songwriters. There are always great songwriters, John Lennon, Bob Dylan, whoever. But there were more of them working at the height of their powers during these years than at any other time.
Harmon, what would you say about why the world needs this book now?
Well, I certainly agree with Michael that it's important. And I think the emphasis that we take as Michael was saying, describing these songs and their greatness through the elements of music, that's melody, harmony, rhythm, form, and the lyrics, brings it to an audience that may not have experienced this before. And I think they also, whether they're music experts or not, doesn't matter. It's a book that can be understood by anybody, old or young, musician or not. It's written in a way that I think brings the reader into the music.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about how different our appreciation of music and our entitlement to music is these days. Everything that we could want to play just about, you can get almost instantly, literally on a smartphone. I once in a while see on social media, although I try to get myself off social media these days just for my mental health. But, you know, there are these channels that tell you, well, if you grew up in the 90s, here's things that kids today wouldn't understand. You know, the 90s, Michael, way back in the 90s. And, you know, one of the common themes is kids growing up today don't understand that, boy, when we grew up in the 80s and 90s, if we wanted to hear our favorite song and we wanted to keep our favorite song around, We had to record it off the radio. We had to hit record and play at the same time on a cassette tape right when the DJ stopped talking so we can listen to our song, unless you wanted to go out and buy a cassette single or an 8-track, the vinyls, etc. And now you just get it whenever you want. You get sick of it right away. Well, when you go back to the 1920s through the 50s, Michael Lasser, I mean, music, I'm one of the biggest surprises is how quickly music went in and out of style, because it's not like people had it at the touch of their fingers.
Well, there are several things at work here in what you said. First of all, music served a different, popular music served a different function than it does now. You talked about the 90s and the 20s. Popular music today defines the generations. A woman once said to me about her son that his music, he played very loudly. And I said, well, tell him to turn it down. And then I put my foot well into my mouth and I said, besides, how different can it be from what you listen to? Yeah. She stood up and she stared me in the eye and she said, please, I'm Springsteen. I had been chastised.
There you are, yes.
But before that, before rock and roll,
yeah,
songs didn't divide the generations. Songs joined. Your grandmother and your mother and you and your kid, if he or she was old enough, could stand around the piano and sing the same songs for hours. You knew songs the others didn't. Each did. But there was a body of song we had in common. I'm not making a value judgment, though I obviously have my preference. I'm saying that they served different social functions. One was to define us generationally. The other was to link us to other generations.
You know, this is another strange reference, but was watching an episode of Frasier recently, where Frasier and Niles sit at the piano with their father, played by John Mahoney, and they're playing songs on piano, and they're all singing together. And I thought, and again, this is a show set in the 90s and the early aughts, and I thought, well, that's quaint, but who does that? Well, you know, if you grew up in the 90s watching Frasier, that was a character who was supposed to be 40, almost 50 years old. He would have grown up in the 40s and 50s. And yes, the family would have sat around, like you said, playing those songs together. And we rarely see that anymore.
I'll tell you some of the differences. The songs that I'm interested in have real melody. Alec Wilder, who was a serious composer, a classical composer from Rochester, wrote a seminal book called American Popular Song, in which he devotes a chapter to each of the major songwriters, Irving Berlin, Harold Arlen, George Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, and so on, in which he talks about what's innovative in their music, even though these are miniatures. So there's a strong sense of melody. Today, a song has a beat. It repeats that one line, da 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 da. Pretty soon, I want to jump off a building. the loss of melody in favor of a strong beat, I think, is a significant loss, or certainly a significant change. The other thing is that song lyrics were witty; they were romantic and witty at the same time.
Subversive.
No, not the songs I'm talking about.
There wasn't a, come on.
Well, a little bit.
Every time you're here, you say, you know, this song's actually about sex. And
how do you talk about love without making room for that? But you had to be indirect.
Yes.
And so you were clever. You were witty. And it's odd because sentiment, emotion, brings you closer. Whereas wit requires that you step back. The emperor has no clothes on. You need to tell truths. They're not supposed to go together. To be funny about love, I mean, come on. And yet these guys and a few women pulled it off. And it's one of the distinguishing characteristics of these songs. You want to hear one? You want to hear an example?
I do.
All right. This is the George and Ira Gershwin's last song together. It's called Love Is Here to Stay. It's from 1938. George died before they finished it. Ira finished it up with a little help from another composer named Vernon Duke, and it's become recognized as one of our great songs. It's called Love Is Here to Stay. Alan?
All right, Alan.
The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend the world and all its capers and how it all will end. Nothing seems to be lasting, but that isn't our affair. We have something permanent, I mean in the way we care. It's very clear, our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know, they must be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay, but our love is here, our love is here, our love is here to stay.
I think we should start with some applause for that.
Nicely done, wasn't it?
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Alan's a friend, and I've worked with him for, it's got to be 30 years.
That is beautiful. Let me ask Harmon. Harmon, what do you hear in that song?
Oh, there's so much. You know, the Gershwins were masters of the craft. I don't want to say like nobody else, but certainly they're up there with the very best. It's a song that swings between major keys and minor keys. It brings out the richness of the words. The Gershwins also have this wonderful way of taking the lyrics and making them so witty and clever. I don't want to go through the specific examples, but I think if I had one thing that I would say that distinguishes the Gershwins from the others, it's their use of syncopation, where the melody might start, but the words don't start until a little beat later. And it brings such a, I don't want to say jazzy, but I would say contemporary for the time, spirit in the song. And it doesn't matter if the song is fast or slow. They know how to do that to bring more emphasis on the things they want to say.
Can I add? it's structured like a joke. In fact, it's structured like a double joke. The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend. That's a grown-up. That's not a teenager. This is 1938 when the world was about to go to hell. The less I comprehend the world and all its problems, no. The world and all its dangers, no. The world and all its capers, that's a surprise word. It's witty. It's clever. See, there's the cleverness, the wit woven in. And it opens the song to wit. Suddenly, the radio, which was very, there was no television, the radio is a passing fancy. What's around? Our love. That you can count on. And at the end, Ira writes, in time, the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble. They're only made of clay. It's a punchline. And then there's a double punchline on top of it. Our love is here to stay. It's an extraordinary song.
You know, Ellie in Rochester sent us a note saying, I grew up listening to Fascinating Rhythm on Saturday mornings.
Me too.
And Ellie says, I am loving this so much. Just hearing Michael's voice is taking me back to my childhood, listening to him on FM. He speaks in such a purposeful way that was as impactful to his listeners then as it is now. Perhaps his delivery is tied to his love of music from a certain period when you really know how to drive home a point.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that a pseudonym? Are you Ellie? No, we know who Ellie is. That's one of your big fans.
Well, that's nice. Thank you, Ellie.
That's really beautiful. And by the way, that we feel the same way about Michael. It's great having Harmon Greenblatt. Michael Lasser and Harmon Greenblatt are the co-authors of Say It With a Beautiful Song. And the book takes us through the Great American Songbook in so many ways. It gets technical. We look at word choice. But, you know, what it really comes down to is the music that Michael used to dance to with his parents in their living room when he was a young teen.
Yes.
You
oh,
did,
my
didn't
goodness.
You?
I did. My
yes,
parents
did.
Were very sociable. Social. They didn't have a great deal of money at that point. And so on Saturday night, they would invite friends over. They would roll up the carpet in the apartment, and they would dance. And I would watch them when I was a little kid. And when I got to be about 11, one night my mother said, come on, Michael, you can do this too. And that night I learned how to do the foxtrot and the rumba.
I love that. I love that. Dallas writes to say, my mom woke me up as a child almost daily with I Love You, A Bushel and a Peck and other songs. He said, I kind of hated it then, but now it's a memory I keep and replay. Now, I don't know if my choice to wake up my son, Dallas, is in the Great American Songbook, maybe out of the period. I don't know. But every morning for my son, when he won't get out of bed, this is what he hears from me.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
That right smack in the
and
middle
of it. And
he
just holds the pillow over his head, and he goes, stop, Dad.
It's a great song, isn't it?
Really, the Great American Songbook is great for waking up young kids.
It's also a revolutionary song because it's the first number, the opening number in Oklahoma. 1943. And up to that point, most musicals began with chorus girls and tap dancing and whoopee. And Rodgers and Hammerstein write this very quiet song that's sung initially by the hero, Curly, off stage. He starts singing off stage. And on stage, you see a middle-aged woman, Aunt Eller, who's sitting in a chair churning butter. And depends on the production, but sometimes Laurie, the heroine, they're going to fall in love, Curly and Laurie, is hanging the wash. It's morning in Oklahoma in 1906 or something, whenever Oklahoma became a state. And this quiet opening was in its time revolutionary.
Michael Lasser, Harmon Greenblatt with us. By the way, let me close this point to get Harmon's opinion on this. I can't stop thinking about this point that Michael made because I think I've grown up, you know, post Great American Songbook, thinking that every generation views its parents' music with kind of eye rolls and views the next generation's music with suspicion. And
nice.
And what Michael is saying is that really may be true now, but music was more connective. It was more a gather around and play it together, enjoy it together, even across generations. It connected generations. Harmon, am I being cynical? Because somebody is going to email me and say, hey, my daughter and I play Taylor Swift on guitar together and we love it. And maybe that's the modern version of this, or maybe things really are different. What do you think, Harmon?
Well, I remember growing up during the 50s, and there was certainly a generation gap when rock and roll came in that, you know, all the adults called it animal music.
Yeah, dangerous.
I mean, and worse things. But I think with rock and roll, also a point we were making before, the songs changed from the emphasis on melody to the emphasis on rhythm. And I don't know if my parents' generation was ready for that. I love these songs that are in the book, but I like rock and roll as well, and classical music too. So I think there's room for all of these things. I think there's, you know, good popular music and bad popular music. I think there's good classical music and bad classical music. But every person has to judge that for themselves.
I think that's well said. Before we get back to a little bit more music, I've got a question for Michael and for Harmon here. I was in an antique store in Hammondsport a couple years ago. And this store right on the main square in Hammondsport has one of my favorite streets in the Finger Lakes, by the way. It's beautiful down there. There were old postcards. They sell old postcards. And some of them were, not just a postcard that was never bought. Some are postcards, you know, that you can read the story. Someone's coming to visit somebody. I mean, I feel like I'm kind of eavesdropping on private conversations. But there was one that I'm trying to think if it's like a man with like holding like a bouquet of flowers, or a woman. Was it a man or a woman? It was a man and a woman laying on the grass in a park. And the postcard says that I just want an old time spoon with you. An old-time spoon with you. Michael Lasser, my 12-year-old, would not know what an old-time spoon is. And I'm not I think it just means a cuddle, a snuggle? No. Oh, boy. Is it more subversive than that?
Necking.
Oh, it's necking.
Necking.
Oh, okay. Well, see? an old-time spoon with you. I was just laughing. I saw this postcard, and I thought, boy, it's amazing how language evolves over time.
One of Jerome Kern's early songs with a lyric by a very minor lyricist named M.K. Rourke.
You write about spoons in the book, I want to say.
How'd you like to spoon with me?
Okay, so
I can't sing.
I think spooning now is just kind of snuggling. Is it? Am I like a prude here? What's going on?
No. There are other songs that address sex.
Okay.
And these times, indirectly.
Yeah.
Do what you done before, baby.
Harmon, you want to add anything to the section on spoons?
Well, I think if you want a lesson in sex through music, Cole Porter is the one listen to, because anytime anything remotely sexual comes up in a Cole Porter song, and he wrote the music and the lyrics, so he knew exactly what was going on. You know that he means much more than he sang. Just an example, the song Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love. They had to add, I think, the Let's Fall in Love part to it.
But Porter had to add that.
Oh,
yes.
That's so interesting. So he couldn't just say, Let's Do It. The implication has to be, what I really mean is let's fall in love.
But everybody knows he does.
Everybody knows. We're not talking about just falling in love.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. But to make it palatable to the commercial side of things.
To get it on the radio. The radio. There was a song in the early 50s that Tony Martin sang called I Get Ideas. When mm-hmm. we are dancing and you're dangerously near me, I get ideas. It was banned from some radio stations. It was a different time.
I mean, Cole Porter is, I get a kick out of you.
Yeah. Porter's word was thing. You've got that thing, meaning there's something about you that's unique, but you've got that thing. You do something to me. You do something to me. almost every use of Porter's in Porter's songs of Thing is sexual.
Cole Porter.
Oh, Dirty Cole.
You
oh,
dog.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Can we listen to a little bit more music?
Absolutely. Alan, I can't remember now what I asked you to prep. if you can do the World War II song, Don't Get Around Much Anymore, that would be great.
Alan is with us here, ready to play, I think.
When I'm not playing solitaire, I take a book down from the shelf. And what with programs on the air, I keep pretty much to myself. Miss the Saturday dance, heard they crowded the floor. I couldn't bear it without you. Don't get around much anymore. Thought I'd visit the club, got as far as the door. They'd have asked me about you. Don't get around much anymore. Well, darling, I guess my mind's more at ease, but nevertheless, why stir up memories? Been invited on dates, might have gone, but what for? It's awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore. Awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore.
The man is outstanding, isn't he? Nancy in Brighton called in to say Alan is one of the musicians of her church and loves him. Who doesn't love him? That voice, that's not...
When he was younger, he sounded even more like Billy Eckstein.
Well, we can't help it. We're all aging every moment of every day. But boy, Alan is. Thank you for that, Alan. I'm going to ask both of our guests once again here. Harmon Greenblatt, what do you hear in that song?
Oh, again, it's a song loaded with interesting things. We haven't talked about the form of the music yet, but as I said it before, it was, you know, one of the elements. And, you know, the form is pretty simple. There's an A theme and then a contrasting theme, and then they come back to the A theme again. But the thing about this song is that because of the rhythm, you know, it's so uneven. It's it's not a smooth romantic ballad type rhythm. It's got all of that jazz and blues inflection to it. It just makes it, again, it grabs the listener and says, boy, you need to listen to this song. And the sentiment, you know, that is in the lyrics, I think even emphasizes this more, because this is a person saying, listen to me.
Michael Lasser?
You probably have figured out by now that Harmon did the music and I did the lyrics and the history. and so it was a good collaboration. It helped that we were friends. It's a World War II song with a strange history. In 1938, Duke Ellington, and that's where the jazz comes from, wrote a jazz piece, an instrumental called Never No Lament. And his agent thought he heard within it a melody that could be made into a song, and he got a man named Bob Russell to write the lyric. And that's what makes it a World War II song. 38 to 42 is when the lyric comes in. These songs are inherently dramatic, theatrical even. Somebody's talking. They're not the songwriter. The songs are not personal. They begin with an introduction. what are the first lines? Oh boy, I should have brought a lyric sheet with me. But those first lines describe a person who's speaking. Nobody else speaks, just this one person. It's probably a woman. A lot of the World War II songs were written to comfort women, to let women say, yeah, that's how it feels, because the men were away and in danger. Then you get to that first A section that Harmon talked about, Miss the Saturday Dance. And there were two of those A sections, same melody, same rhyme pattern, different words, obviously. And then there's a break from that. It's called either the release, because you don't have to do that same melody again, or it's called the bridge, because it's connected to the third A that comes after. So it's A, A, B, A. Darling, I guess my heart's ill at ease. And why do I want to bring up memories? That's a different angle. I don't want to think about this stuff. But then the woman can't resist it. And then the A section, it's been invited on dates, which tells you who she's talking to. She's talking to her lover or husband who's far away. I've been invited on dates, but I don't go. When I got to the club, I got as far as the door. They'd have asked me about you. Don't get around much anymore. It's elliptical. Words are left out. But there's a story here about this woman who goes to the club where she's known. And everybody who have said, Sally, how's Charlie? She can't bear that. Thought I'd visit the club, got as far as the door. They'd have asked me about you. Don't get around much anymore. It's a powerful story.
The book that we're talking about is Say It With a Beautiful Song, The Art and Craft of the Great American Songbook. The co-authors, Michael Lasser and Harmon Greenblatt, are with us, Alan Jones, providing the music. Dan writes in to ask about if race comes into question here. And the answer is yes, and I want to talk about a couple of things here. First of all, in the first section of the book, Craft and Authenticity, talk about the time of Tin Pan Alley, the Tenderloin, a rougher neighborhood on Manhattan's west side where white people and black people would dance together. And even respectable elders raised objections. The president of New York City's police board said that ragtime dancing in public must be stopped. Stopped, Michael Lasser. This was back in 1910. Irving Berlin was put out Grizzly Bear in 1910?
Grizzly Bear was 1910, and Alexander's ragtime band, his most famous ragtime song, was 1911.
I mean, it's not unimaginable, but it's kind of hard to think about a time now where elders in the neighborhood are going, wait, are those white people and black people dancing together? But it was, right?
Oh, yes. You really haven't, if you're younger than 50, you have no idea what it was like to be black in America in those days.
I'm also looking at this question of, you know, if certain lines were crossed, Irving Berlin was a traditionalist who, you're right, that sometimes used minstrelry in his works, even after it was pretty well understood that that was offensive.
He was just blind to it. He thought it was an essential American music, and it is. We don't like to talk about it, but it was the dominant form of American show business from the 1830s, still slavery, into the 1910s.
What's an example? Alexander's Ragtime Band?
Well, that's not a minstrel song.
Okay.
A Darktown Strutter's Ball, O Susanna. If you read some of the other verses of O Susanna, you would go hide under your bed. The N-word flies.
Ugh.
In a lot of the songs from the turn of the century, they're called coon songs.
Oh, boy.
And they come out of the minstrel tradition. The minstrel tradition is dying
And what
out.
Was Berlin's resistance to learning about this, to changing?
He was both a traditionalist and an innovator at the same time. And he had a photograph of Stephen Foster, our first great songwriter, on the wall of his office. And Foster survived by writing songs for minstrel shows. So romantic ballads like Beautiful Dreamer, Wake Unto Me, but also coon songs, because that's what they were very popular. They were popular from around 1880 to 1910, roughly. And rather than going, go back, put your feet in their shoes, and before you decide, I hate that, we all do, understand it. Don't just dismiss it. Because if you dismiss it out of ignorance, or you dismiss it on the assumption that you are morally superior, well, take a look at the world. I'm not sure we were put here to complete God's plan.
Michael, I will say this. I think it is essential that if we're going to understand how flawed human beings are and our own imperfect history and our own imperfect selves, we do try to understand context. Context doesn't excuse. Context doesn't make it, you know, morally acceptable in today's terms. But it is important to try to understand, well, how did they get there? Where are we now? Where are our shortcomings now? I think that's fair.
Some of the writers of coon songs were black.
Harmon, you want to weigh in on that before we move on to the next section?
Yeah, I think Michael's point is good. You know, these people were just trying to earn a living. And if they wanted to write songs that people wanted to listen to and buy the sheet music of to play on their pianos at home. And I think that as despicable as we think it is today, I think the context is important. And I will also say one other thing, that it didn't end in 1910 either. And we can get into people wearing blackface when they sang Al Jolson, you know, years after that, and Eddie Cantor. And if you want to take one example, in the 1920s, Old Man River, the first word of Old Man River as it was written is the N-word.
By the way, that was all prompted from a text from Dan. Thank you, Dan, for that question. And we're getting all kinds of feedback. It's already 1:43. We're going to have to listen to more music in a second. But let me just read a little bit more of the feedback coming in. Phil, who, by the way, Phil Broyko is a great songwriter himself, says, for me, the previously mentioned Let's Fall in Love isn't as much scandalous as it is hilarious. You have to take a closer look at the lyrics to understand the real humor in this song. I don't think it's necessarily meant to scandalize. Rather, it's to make the listener laugh, and still cracks me up to this day, almost 100 years after it was published. Oh, there is some whimsy and fun in that song.
Oh, Porter was extremely clever.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen Menden says, good to hear Michael's voice again. The Great American Songbook is alive and well with young artists like Rochester native Sage Melcher singing Cole Porter in venues around the world. I heard her with Don Potter at Eastman years ago, and then at the Iridium with Les Paul, who called her My Little Judy. She was a Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook ambassador for New York State and continues to promote this wonderful genre. Just heard her at Verve, Herb Albert's in L.A. Amazing how the Great American Songbook is being kept alive and truly appreciated by the younger generations, Michael Lasser.
There are lots of crossover albums now. The first of them, both rock singers and classical singers, want to sing these songs. The first of them, I think, was Linda Ronstadt, who did them very, very well. My problem is that I think a lot of them don't do them very, very well. Mm-hmm. And they're simply making sounds. They don't know how to
the sensibility of a song.
Yeah, they don't know how to penetrate to the emotion. That's the rock singers, because so much of rock performing is spectacle, and they don't know how to hone in on this miniature, this precious miniature that offers them an encounter with deep emotion. At the same time, the classical singers bring all that technique. They don't know how to loosen up, and they beat those poor little songs to death. You want to hear something both funny and disheartening. Joan Sutherland, the great opera star, did an album of Noel Coward. And to hear her sing Mad Dogs and Englishmen makes you want to weep. It's so bad.
Well, let me add, though, that sometimes they do get it, like Renee Fleming.
Yes, absolutely.
She is terrific doing popular American songs.
Well, Rochester's own, thank you.
And a Rochester, an American kid who sang opera. She grew up on the stuff. Another one is, what's her name? When you get old, the proper nouns are the first to go. Did the Showboat recording, Harmon, what's her name? Frederica von Stade.
Yes.
Does the songs in Showboat magnificently.
By the way, Marty writes to say, Mr. Lasser was my English teacher in middle and high school.
Marty who?
Marty Maloney. Marty W. Marty says, we had a program, I think it was called Focus Groups, where we could pick an elective. Mr. Lasser taught a very popular class about Broadway music, which may have been the precursor to Fascinating Rhythm. As adults, my husband and I listened to his show every Saturday, so your show brings back lots of memories, fun memories. Hi, Mr. Lasser.
Hi, Marty.
How about that?
I wonder if her maiden name is Maine. Marty Maine. Could be.
Okay. Marty, thank you for that. Okay. Should we hear a little bit more music here,
yeah,
Michael?
Alan, do you have a third song ready, Alan? just play it.
Alan Jones.
Things have come to a pretty pass. Our romance is growing flat. For you like this and the other, while I go for this and that. Goodness knows what the end will be. Oh, I don't know where I'm at. It looks as if we two will never be one. Something must be done. You say either, and I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato, and I like potato. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we ever part, then that would break my heart. So if you like pajamas and I like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas and give up pajamas. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off off. Let's call the whole thing off. You say laughter and I say laughter. You say after and I say after. Laughter, laughter, after, after. Let's call the whole thing off. You like vanilla and I like vanilla. You sarsaparilla and I sarsaparilla. Vanilla, vanilla, chocolate, strawberry. Let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we ever part, then that would break my heart. So if you go for oysters and I go for oysters, I'll order oysters and cancel the oysters. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off off. Let's call the whole thing off.
Frivolous, playful. It feels like a casual affair is ending. And then suddenly, the bridge, the part that breaks the melody, that makes the song dramatic, but oh, if we call the whole thing off, he suddenly realizes what's at stake here. And so in the midst of all this playfulness, this cleverness, this matters. It becomes real. And then when he reaffirms that at the end, it gets playful again. Better call the calling off.
Right. But can Alan Jones do this on roller skates? Can he do the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers? Wonderful, Alan.
He's a cockeyed wonder, mainly cockeyed.
Harmon, what do you hear there?
Yes, well, I was thinking of Fred and Ginger while Alan was singing, and how I think they really make this song. It's their song. Other artists, I'm sure, have recorded it well, but I don't think I can ever listen to this song and not envision Fred and Ginger on roller skates sitting on that bench in the park.
Well, I mean, he just came in. He's not on roller skates, disappointingly. welcome, by the way. Can you get that microphone close to you in studio here?
I can.
Oh, my goodness gracious. You've got that beautiful, deep, rich... Where did you learn to do that, sir? That was outstanding.
Mom and Dad gave that to me.
Are you thinking about Fred and Ginger and the playfulness and the history when you're... Are you trying to get inside? Because Michael is sometimes critical of people who are performing music now not knowing the sensibility. And Michael gave you high marks for nailing the sensibility in these songs. How much are you thinking about that?
Oh, all the time. And I have to attribute that to working with Michael for the last 30 years, because he's not shy about chiding me for not interpreting the lyrics correctly.
He's a good teacher.
I might listen to a recording where somebody replaced a lyric with a different word, and he says, no, you can't do that. This is why.
If the lyricist or the composer wanted to use that word or that note, he would have.
Yeah.
Now, we're not talking about jazz. That's a whole other thing. But they knew what they were doing. In fact, some of the composers, Richard Rodgers and Jerome Kern most notably, disliked jazz because they changed what they'd written. If they wanted to have it to be that way, that's what they would have written.
I think I'm going to turn this into a textbook for my 12-year-old son's culture study this year. He's going to read this Great American Songbook. This is so much fun. And before we lose the hour here, I want to mention that there's so much that we didn't get to, and really great insight into what is predictable and unpredictable in music. Michael writes that predictability produces profit. And people like what they know. People like what's comfortable. That's true today. It was true then. But Berlin said that if you lead listeners in a direction and then you pivot a little, you surprise them, then you can take what is predictable and make it surprisingly unpredictable. There's a lot of examples of this. We could talk Wizard of Oz, which people could relate to. You want to say something about predictability and unpredictability, Mike?
Yeah. The surprise words, like capers, where'd that come from? It changes the whole song. The playful rhyming. Yip Harburg, wrote all the lyrics for The Wizard of Oz, including all the "If I Only Had a Heart and a Brain and the Knife." He's playing in those lyrics. He's twisting words. He's making up words. These people who wrote these lyrics, like the composers, were enormously inventive. And I think that's one of their hallmarks.
He's making up words, twisting a little bit at times. And there's a bit of an Ogden Nash characteristic to that, the great Ogden Nash
sure.
Zoo.
Who wrote musicals, by the way, wrote two or three musicals.
Ogden Nash, I just know him for his zoo and his social commentary.
Well, he wrote lyrics for some shows.
See all the things that you can learn when you have an hour with Michael Lasser and Harmon Greenblatt and Alan Jones. What a great time we have had here. Where is this book available, Michael Lasser?
One way you can is to get it from me.
This beautiful book
you can
coming also great
get,
from you.
You can get it from Harman as well. What you have to, is there a way for people to contact me?
Sure, of course. I mean, I'm looking at the publisher, Roman and Littlefield, ROWMAN.com. I assume you could get it through there.
No, yeah, better off. You might as well go to
Amazon has it too.
Yeah,
Amazon.
But we prefer that you buy it from us because we make more money that
but
way.
But Jeff Bezos needs the money. Are you not worried about him? No, he sticks his tongue out there. Harman, before we lose the hour, just about 45 seconds, what do you want to leave with listeners as we think about the Great American Songbook?
I think that the Great American Songbook is for everyone, and you shouldn't feel that anything should stand in your way from enjoying this music. And I think that also this music is the foundation for so much music that has come after it. And, you know, I can hear in these songs, other songs from the rock era, from even contemporary times that use this as their basis. I mean, sometimes they call it sampling, but other times they give due credit to it as well. So don't be put off because this music may be 80 or 90 years old. It's still great.
Harman, thank you for making time for us this hour. Really been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much.
The co-author, Harman Greenblatt, the co-author, Michael Lasser, and the book is Say It With a Beautiful Song, The Art and Craft of the Great American Songbook. Thank you, Alan, for the music this hour.
My pleasure.
Please come back sometime and be the soundtrack of our lives. Michael, always a pleasure, my friend.
And for me too, Evan.
Your listeners, I love hearing from them. They love hearing you on this program. We drag Michael back here as much as we possibly
can. Hey, if you're listening and you got a pencil, 455-7651, text me and I'll work out a good way for you to get the book.
Or you can help Jeff Bezos. And the Bezos Fund. It's called Amazon.com.
Yeah, but
say it with beautiful song.
But with me, you get an inscription.
Thank you, my friend. From the whole team at Connections, especially thanks to Ben Kaufman and Rob and George, especially, thank you for the great work. We'll talk with you tomorrow.